them.
What is that? What I don't know. Is Mindy over yet?
It was just me and Lively at 1 o'clock.
Straight just up. Continue.
I'm having a very
I have never appreciated the weekend so much as I do now.
He's gained a better appreciation.
Yes.
Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order for Wednesday, March 11th, 2015, and open up a public hearing. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 3041. What do we have here, Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3041 directs school districts to allow students to use sun protective clothing and sunscreen, specifies that the non-prescription sunscreen is not a medication, declares an emergency effective July 1, 2015. Just for the committee's information, we have a no revenue and a minimal fiscal impact on the bill, Mr. Chair.
You call the first panel, please.
I will. And I apologize ahead of time if I mispronounce anybody's name.
I'm going to ask you, all the witnesses say we have a lot of work. Take as much time as you need, but be as brief as you possibly can.
Nikki Steinsyke, Liz Sokolowski, Sylvia Peterson-Perry.
I make her call up the panel so I don't have to struggle with the names. She does way better than I do with it. Please, when you start your testimony, state your name for the record, and then go for it.
Okay, can we begin?
Yes.
All right. Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nikki Steinsyke, and I'm a first-year medical student in the combined MD and Masters of Public Health program at OHSU. I am from Ashland, Oregon, and hope to practice family medicine in the future in Oregon. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 3041. I would like to start by explaining where the idea for the bill came from. The Health Policy Interest Group is a group of medical students at OHSU who decided to learn the legislative process by working on a public health issue that could benefit our future patients. In that research, we discovered that there was an OHSU donor who had wished to distribute sunscreen at a high school sporting event in order to protect students from getting sunburned. But given the ambiguity of the current Oregon statute, the school administrators declined the donation. Currently, school policies concerning sunscreen vary widely across Oregon because it is unclear whether students are legally allowed to bring and apply their own sunscreen at school. To investigate further into schools' policies, one of our classmates called about 10 different schools all across the state. We found that while they were unclear, while they were clear about rules pertaining to over-the-counter medication such as ibuprofen, when asked about sunscreen, the schools answered very widely, and some schools were unsure even how to answer the question. The reason why this may be confusing to schools is sunscreen has several active ingredients and a drug facts label and is considered an over-counter drug by the FDA. Oregon regulation specifically names that what specifically names over-the-counter drugs that it can be brought to school, such as Advil, topical steroid creams, and antihistamines. Since sunscreen is not specifically called out in this list, schools have various policies. House Bill 3041 was designed to address these discrepancies and allow students to use non-prescription sunscreen and sun protective clothing during school hours and at school-sponsored activities. It specifically exempts sunscreen from the definition of medication, which clarifies the issue for schools and also relieves the burden on providers to write notes for sunscreen, which does happen now. It allows school districts the flexibility to adopt rules outlining how to manage sunscreen at school, the type of clothing permitted, and protect school personnel from liability relating to the application of sunscreen. We think it is important for parents to have the option to send their kids to school with sunscreen and that schools have clarity around this issue. We think that House Bill 3041 helps address those issues. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and we will be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Yeah. Chair Greenlich and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Sokolowski. I'm from Corvallis and a second-year medical student at OHSU. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 3041. Before medical school, I worked as a chemical engineer for 13 years. but I became increasingly drawn to helping people, especially children, suffering from life-threatening illness. I'm particularly interested in oncology, and that is why I'm here today. Because we have the opportunity to do something simple to prevent the suffering and loss of life due to cancer. Just as we know smoking increases lung cancer risk, we also know sun exposure and burns increase the likelihood of skin cancer. In fact, unprotected sun exposure is the most preventable risk factor for skin cancer. Here are some facts that might be surprising. In Oregon, incidence and mortality of melanoma, the deadliest form of skin cancer, are increasing. We have the fifth highest rate of melanoma in the country, whereas places like California, Texas, and Florida don't even make the top 10. Nationwide, pediatric melanoma rates are going up at 2% per year. And melanoma is now the most common form of cancer for young adults and the second most common for adolescents. Thankfully, we have a safe and effective way to prevent some of these cancers. Research shows much of our sun exposure happens when we are children, and daily sunscreen use can cut the incidence of melanoma in half. Yet, while we diligently apply sunscreen to children on weekends, by not allowing children to bring sunscreen to school, we leave them unprotected during the week. My sister has three children in the California school system, which is the only state in the country that explicitly allows sunscreen at school. As part of their daily routine, they apply sunscreen in the morning and again before recess. Personally, I can recall coming home from school with sunburns as a child. House Bill 3041 would allow parents the option for their children to use sunscreen in school in order to protect them from melanoma and other skin cancers. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and we would be happy to answer any questions.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sylvia Peterson-Perry, and I am a second-year medical student in the combined MD-MPH program at OHSU. I grew up in Portland, and I'm interested in staying in Oregon and practicing family medicine in underserved communities. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 3041. As my classmates have already mentioned, House Bill 3041 is related to skin cancer prevention among school children. This is an important public health issue because of the morbidity and mortality associated with melanoma, but also a financial issue. It costs the country over $3 billion each year to treat melanoma, and this cost is increasing disproportionately relative to all other cancers. Some people think that Oregon is a rainy state and that skin cancer is less of an issue here. However, we actually have a high enough UV radiation index that the EPA recommends application of sunscreen every 2 hours. Some areas of Oregon receive more UV radiation than others, in particular areas south of the Willamette Valley and east of the Cascades, which have the highest UV exposure during the year. Liz talked about the high incidence of melanoma in our state, but the one good thing about melanoma is that you can modify your risk factors of getting it, especially if you act during childhood. We know that just one blistering sunburn during childhood doubles a person's lifetime risk of developing melanoma. We also know that more than 40% of a person's lifetime sun exposure happens before the age of 20. The Centers for Disease Control has made three specific recommendations on how to prevent sunburns, including the regular use of sunscreen, use of hats and protective clothing, and sun avoidance. In regards to sunscreen, they recommend application every 2 hours, which for kids generally necessitates reapplication by the time lunch recess rolls around. Finally, this bill will complement earlier legislation to increase physical education hours in our schools by 2017. We know that kids will be outside more and getting more sun exposure. We want children to be outside exercising for a variety of health reasons, and hopefully this bill will help them be as sun safe as possible during those hours. By allowing sunscreen in schools, we give parents the freedom to protect their children from sunburns, give schools clearer instructions on how to handle sunscreen, and hopefully prevent melanoma in Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and we would be happy to answer any questions.
This bill was sponsored by me and by Representative Buehler, and normally we would have kicked off, but we're just the de jure sponsors of this one. This is your bill, and you've done a great job getting it this far. Are there any questions of this panel? Representative Kennedy? No.
Hayden.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. I do have one question, and I support the bill and have actually thought I was a sponsor, just a regular sponsor on it, but have made that request to be a sponsor on it. But I'd like one clarification in line 11A. It talks about sun protective clothing. Is there, and normally I'm supposed to know the answer to these before I ask them, but I don't know the answer to this one. Is there any requirements within our school system that don't allow for, like, hoodies? You know, it talks about hats, but is there a conflict with any of the school's policies not to allow hoodies? And I do see it, that it addresses it outdoors, but it doesn't say on sunny days. And I'm not trying to be, you know, opposed to it, but is that an issue that we have explored?
I can't personally speak to the Suns or Representative Greenlick and the committee. I can't personally speak to the whether or not there's anything related to hoodies, but in terms of like exposure to the sun, even on cloud, like even on cloudy days, you are getting exposure to UV radiation, and so I think it something like that would be. But.
Granted.
Do you know anything about hoodies?
So, just to clarify your question, are you wondering if possibly the us saying requiring that students can wear sun protective clothing contradicts existing regulations against hoodies?
That is it.
Okay.
Thank you.
So
yeah.
That's a great question, and I think that that's we specifically say that school boards can make their own determinations at the school board level regarding how they want to enforce or like where they want sunblock to be available, and I imagine that would extend to specifics about sun protective clothing as well, but that's something that we can check back on and get back to you.
Yes.
So in line 5, section 1.1, it says each school district shall, instead of may, says that they shall follow these, and so that's where my question with, you know, we're talking about the sweatshirt with the hood that covers not only the sun, but possibly identification of who the student is. And my question was, and I apologize, I didn't have time to research it, do any of the school districts have policies that don't allow that?
So, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, thank you for that question. I think it's a good question. I don't think we know the answer right now, and we would like to research that and get back to you today or later tomorrow, unless someone who's testifying after us can provide some additional information.
But the issue is that the school districts can make their own policies around this. Is not. So if they don't want hoodies, then they can make that. Senator Widener?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think to get to what Representative Hayden is after, we kind of hit it in the amendment. It looks like the application and use of the students at non-prescription sunscreen. We let the districts make the policy, but one of the questions, I wonder if we shouldn't have addressed a certain SPF level, because if they don't have a policy in place and they just allow them to do sunscreen, lots of kids want to get dark. I have four boys, and with their skin tone and everything, they get very dark and they don't want sunscreen on, and sometimes they're using baby oil and calling that. So, I mean, can call it sunscreen, and there's tanning stuff out there, so
this doesn't force children to use sunscreen.
Doesn't force them to wear it, but I'm just wondering if they can go out and use something like that and say, oh, I'm putting sunscreen on, when really they're oiling up to get darker. But, I mean, they do it anyway, and baby oil's, I guess, allowed in school. So, but I'm wondering if we want to put an SPF level of 15 or some or greater in here. Do you see what I'm getting at, Mr. Chair?
I think if we put that in, you'd be arguing that we're taking away the freedom of your. So I don't know how we can find some way to get
the type,
you on the right side.
Well, we're letting the district do it, but if the district adopts these policies, that it should be at like SPF 10 or 15. You're looking
directly
at somebody who gets burnt all the time.
If I don't directly with your school district.
Yeah.
Let's have the next panel. Oh, is there somebody else?
Yes, there is.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
I was going to, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to make the same comment as you, that our good libertarian friend here is trying to, you know, make it more clear about what schools should and shouldn't do. And I think the spirit of this is fabulous, that you're saying they do have to allow it. You know, it is not saying they may allow. It's saying they shall allow. We are not going to let school districts have a policy that doesn't allow it. I wouldn't go so far as to say what SPF factor they should, you know, that what they should be mandating. I just think it's hysterical. You're the one thinking about it.
We all agree.
We're arguing against each other, opposite of what we normally do.
You're looking at the person,
these local people,
the person
what
who
they
gets burnt worse than anybody. I've had second and third degree sunburn.
Yeah, you're about the same color as your shirt right now. So.
Thank you. Let's have the next panel. Hey, Sally, two of these students are in the MD-MPH program, which I was pleased to say I was the co-founder of.
Oh.
And the best students in the country come to join that program. Next panel.
Melissa Wilmot, Dr. Sansi Leachman, Ashley Tracy, and Kelly Polson.
You're going to pull up four chairs.
I will.
I see five.
Okay. Oh, there you go.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Such service. Thank you.
Let's go.
Okay, so I'll get started. I'm Cincy Leachman. I am the director of the melanoma program at Knight Cancer Institute and also the chair of the Department of Dermatology. And one of the things I want to thank you guys for is that you've created, obviously, a very teachable moment with this. This bill is a very teachable moment. And for that reason, I have prepared not only my written testimony, but a little handout in case anybody wants to
check. You can sit down.
You know. Yeah, but I'm getting ready to stand up. So if you can pass them, that'd be great. So I don't want to spend a lot of time. I know this is you guys have been very supportive. I do want to start out just by mentioning that the we are supporting a friendly amendment that will be presented that will help with the school board association that will allow us to clarify some of those questions about what the guidelines have to include, so that should address your question that you made earlier. The other thing that I'd like to say is that I'm going to just read this so I don't go over time, that melanoma skin cancer disproportionately targets younger and active individuals, and that's an important point. Invasive skin cancer, in case everyone didn't realize it, is the most common cancer in young adults aged 25 to 29, and it affects and kills more individuals under the age of 35 than any other of the top five cancers. So I think that's an unknown fact, and it disproportionately affects our socioeconomics that have to do with cancer, because it affects young people in their prime, in their childbearing years, etc. Ultraviolet light, it's unquestionable that it causes melanoma, squamous cell carcinoma, and basal cell carcinoma. And you can look in the fun facts. You can fact check me on that. That's why I provided you the references and all the detail. It basically causes DNA damage is what it does. It's just like any other form of radiation, like an X-ray. It's just not quite as intense. But it causes that DNA damage, the mutations, and then that leads to alteration of the proteins, which causes uncontrolled growth and cancer development. So I think that that's pretty well established fact. If anybody has any questions, happy to talk to that.
It's clear. My understanding is that if we work the bill, you propose the amendment be done on the Senate side.
Yes, exactly. I'm sorry I didn't say that. That's exactly what I intended. Yeah. I think the other thing that I want everybody here to be made aware of is that we have started at OHSU under my leadership a war on melanoma. And that war is intended to basically attack by education, by a massive educational outreach to lay people, service industries that deal with the skin, such as acupuncturists and massage therapists, hairdressers, and also medical professionals, how you can detect melanoma earlier when it's treatable. And through that, I think that one of the elements of this bill, this bill will attack one of those elements, which is early prevention. and in childhood where they're most vulnerable. So scientific data supports a causal relationship between ultraviolet light exposure and melanoma that, if minimized, can lead to reduced death from the disease. And I encourage your support of the bill 3041A, which will favorably impact our community, families, children, and grandchildren, and will establish our state as a proactive and preventative state from the perspective of skin cancer. Thank you very much for your time today. I'll pass it on to some of our patients who have specific personal stories to tell.
Thank you.
Hello. Thank you for having me. My name is Kelly Poulsen Grill. They have me just listed as Kelly Poulsen, but I am a married woman now. And I am a melanoma cancer survivor. I live in Wilsonville, Oregon. And 3 years ago, I got that awful phone call where my dermatologist called and told me that I had cancer. And my cancer is from when I was a little girl. I was 10 years old. I've been a horsewoman my whole life. And I would ride horses in the hot sun without any sunblock. And being a redhead, I was pretty well almost destined to get something that happened with my skin, and it was, we affectionately call it my shark bite, but it was a definite skin cancer melanoma from being in the hot sun as a little girl, and it came up 31 years later. So I am strongly, strongly supporting this bill and so thankful that you all are too, so that we can get sunblock on our children and help to prevent that scary phone call that you don't want them to get as an adult. And thankfully, I got clean margins and I didn't have to do any radiation or chemotherapy, but it was very scary nonetheless. My husband buried his first wife from breast cancer, and he was worried he was going to bury his second wife from melanoma. So I just thank you so much for your time and your support of this, and I'm happy to answer any questions if any of you have any.
Thank you for being here.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ashley Tracy, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 3041, which will allow children to bring and use sun protection, including sunscreen, in Oregon schools. Growing up in Oregon in the 80s, my parents had us out in the sun all the time, as much as possible, what I can remember. And during all that time, I don't recall a single time having sunscreen applied when we were outside. I remember I would blister so badly, and I remember how painful it was, but it never stopped us from basking in the sun whenever possible. I then continued to believe, as I got older, that tanning beds, long tanning sessions in the sun, and tanning enhancers like oils would never give someone like me cancer. Sorry. Then 2 years ago, almost to this very day, I was diagnosed with stage 1 melanoma. Sorry.
Take a breath.
It turned my world upside down. At that time, my son would be turning 1 year old shortly after my diagnosis. And I just remember thinking I may not ever see him grow up. Being a new mom, I had a lot of fears and emotions to overcome. In my case, the mole was caught early and removed, and I was very fortunate in that case. This experience has made me more aware of changes on my body and more educated of what to look for. It has also made me more aware than ever before about the consequences of sunburn at a young age and the importance of using sun protection, both sun protective clothing and sunscreen, to protect myself and my children from the serious consequences of melanoma. My son Parker is now almost 3, and I have another sweet little boy, Connor, who is almost 1. My children and other children in Oregon are the number one reason I'm here today. As I look at both of my boys with their blue eyes, light-colored hair, and fair skin, I can't help but truly fear as they grow up that they may have their mother's skin and be vulnerable to developing melanoma. So I'm here today because it is important that we take precautions that we can minimize our children's risk of skin cancer. Our children are in school a significant amount of time during the day, and it is so important that they would be able to have access to apply and reapply sunscreen and use protective clothing. This is a preventable disease, and it's important that we are all educated about the risk and have the opportunity to protect ourselves and our children. Please support House Bill 3041 and allow parents like me to protect my children from the consequences of overexposure while they're at school. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you. I was just thinking there's a bond among those of us that have gotten that phone call in one form or another.
Absolutely.
Very special moment. Yes, please go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thank you. Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Melissa Wilmot, and I live in Portland, specifically in Representative Greenlick's district.
Yay.
Thank you for allowing me to testify today. I'm here in support of House Bill 3041, a bill that, as you have heard, would allow children access to sunscreen while at school. I'm interested in this issue because my oldest son started kindergarten in September at Forest Park Elementary in Northwest Portland, and I would like to make sure he and other children at school have the option to put on sunscreen when they go outside. As the weather gets nicer, except for today, they are spending more and more time outdoors during PE and during recess. And I'm wholeheartedly in support of fresh air and running around outside. It's how I grew up. But I just want to ensure my son can protect himself from the sun when he is. It's a particularly important issue for me because I was diagnosed with melanoma 10 years ago next month at the age of 24. I was planning my wedding, and all I wanted to do was to be able to walk down the aisle without my crutches. Months after my surgery, and thanks to both my parents helping me down the aisle, I did it. More recently, when I was 6 months pregnant in 2011, I was diagnosed again, and then in 2013, and then last summer. Having been diagnosed with melanoma 4 times in the past decade, I'm very committed to making sure my children are protected from the sun as well. My doctors and I believe a combination of sunburns as a child, as well as my skin type and blue eyes and brown hair, put me at risk for melanoma. Given that melanoma can be hereditary, I worry that my children are also at risk. And I, of course, want to try and limit their sun exposure, so that's not a contributing factor. Currently, I apply sunscreen to my 6- and 3-year-old, three-year-olds back there, before they go to school. My 6-year-old's now getting old enough where he can apply some himself, but it's scattered and, you know, I think if he actually got burned, it would look like a puzzle, so we're working on that. When my 6-year-old was in preschool and during summer school, staff would only reapply sunscreen after 3 o'clock. So if I applied at 8 o'clock in the morning, reapplying after 3 p.m. really would allow him to be vulnerable during the middle of the day in the harshest rays when he was outside playing. Both my sons have visited my dermatologist and have had several moles photographed and documented by her office, and I know that they're going to be visiting the dermatologist every several years for the foreseeable future. This bill would enable a straightforward process by which my kindergartner and other children could apply sunscreen at school if their parents would like them to. Given that it's recommended to reapply sunscreen every 2 hours, it seems important that there be a mechanism in place for kids to reapply it while at school or at after-school events. We know that melanoma, as has been mentioned, is one of the most preventable cancers, so it's up to us to help put a stop to future incidences. I want to protect my children and every child from the physical pain and scars that I have from melanoma, and more than that, I want to protect them from the emotional pain that a cancer diagnosis can give you, the fear of its return, and the daily desire to turn back time. I wish I could go back and be even better with my own skin protection as a child, and that's why I support House Bill 3041, and thank you for your time. Happy to answer any questions, too.
Thank you. Are there any questions to this panel? Representative Kate Geyer?
Do you want me to go first?
Yep, and then Representative Wyden.
Well, thank you, and thank you for bringing back the seriousness of this issue. You know, we kind of rib our colleagues when they do something that appears to us out of character, but I think one of the reasons that it is out of character for somebody who, you know, doesn't like a lot of government intervention is because it's such a critical issue that it would kind of rise to the level where we would all really care about this. I just want to say on a personal level, my mom died of skin cancer. Both my sister and brother have had melanoma. I have had squamous cell. It's a very serious issue. I appreciate the leadership of OHSU, who brought us the sun tanning bill for minors last time around, and then supporting you on this bill this time around. So thank you so much for your testimony. It's very compelling and touching.
I'm sorry for your loss.
Senator Wyden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's great to have you here. And just dealing with skin cancer, I have a stepfather who's done it. You're looking at somebody who's had second and third degree sunburns where my arm was froze to this level when I was in Mexico when I was a kid. So out in the sun playing baseball and everything at the same time. And to me, some of the stuff that we do, it's ludicrous that schools would not allow you to put sunscreen on. It's just like, why can't a child take aspirin to school? I mean, if you're dealing with headaches and stuff. So it's not so much about government intervention. It's government's been intervening and not letting people do this. Well, so true. It's about freedom is what it is.
Okay, yes. Government on the way.
So it means
this still is. It was your recommendation.
Favor for
so you went on both sides. The Libertarian Republicans saying, yes, let them take their sunscreen. And on the Democratic side, mandate that they take their sunscreen. It's a win-win bill.
We'll give you a chance to vote on it in a minute. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3041 and open a work session on House Bill 3041.
Chair Greenlee, I move that House Bill 3041, I move House Bill 3041 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Representative Hayden moves House Bill 3041 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I saw some dash one amendments on OLIS.
They want to handle those in the Senate.
Okay. So, because I was reading those and they looked a little better than the regular bill.
I think it will approve the bill.
Okay.
So just send it over there. Give them something to do. So they feel they own it.
The Senate smarter? Is that what they're trying to say?
I wouldn't say that. You call the roll, please.
Representative Buehler?
Yes.
Representative Clem?
Excuse.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative
Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Leibwig?
Aye.
Representative Weiner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries. Bill's on the way to the floor. Let's have Representative Buehler and Kenny Geyer co-chair it, and let them flip a coin for who goes first.
You can go first.
Okay. Close the work session on House Bill 3041. We're going to open up first let me announce we're carrying over House Bill 2541 to Friday, or perhaps carry it again till the following Monday. There's work afoot that will perfect the bill and get everybody on the same path, we hope. Are we opening three at once now?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Which three? First three?
Yes.
Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2022, House Bill 2023, and House Bill 2948. Representative Kenny Geyer, are you going to lead us off on this one?
I would.
And is Representative Frederick coming?
Yes, okay. He wants to come. I want to make sure he gets texted. Sorry. Sorry.
Here he is.
Oh, he's here?
Representative Frederick, will you join us, please? Are we going to call witnesses according to the bill, or what are we going to do?
I think maybe she is. Sure. There's a lot of overlap.
We have three public hearings at the same time going on, so you can speak about any of the bills you want to.
Any one, huh?
Or anything else, actually.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chairs, colleagues. I'll start it off. I'm Alyssa Kennegeyer, House District 46, and I'm really honored to be bringing these three bills forward. Mental health issues have mostly been in Human Services Committee up until this time, and we had some really compelling testimony by some people that you're going to hear right after Representative Frederick and me in front of the Human Services Committee in September, interim days, as well as in front of the Senate Health and Human Services Committee about the angst that they had with their adolescent children trying to get mental health services through acute care and the lack of adequate discharge. And so we worked together to develop some bill concepts around making sure that there is, at a bare minimum, some protocol around discharge, and then backing up from that, making sure that at a bare minimum there is some case management and care coordination that can allow for favorable outcomes with discharge and step down, and then backing up even further from that, that there really needs to be clarification of HIPAA, because part of adequate care coordination and discharge, particularly for an adolescent population, is making sure that the people people in their lives, the family or chosen family or other lay caregivers, are adequately informed about how to support them. And so since proposing several concepts, we got those back in early December by the bill deadline. We pulled together some people, a wide variety of stakeholders. Representative Frederick was there for at least at one of the meetings. Representative Joe Gallegos, Senator Gelser's representative, Senator Elizabeth Steiner Hayward herself. We had meetings in December and January, and then a meeting just yesterday to look at the different concepts here, to look at two new amendments, one of them for the discharge 2023. And another amendment for House Bill 2948, which is the HIPAA. So we continue to further refine these, particularly as we hear about other bills that are going through either chamber, mostly on the Senate side. There's one on discharge, there's another one on HIPAA, CARE Act. We're looking at how we can merge some of these concepts. So I'm really pleased with the direction. We've got very strong involvement. That doesn't necessarily mean agreement, but we have very strong involvement by hospital association, by insurance providers, by providers themselves, and strong consumer voice. This started with consumer voice. We are always going back to the consumers to make sure that they are the ones that are telling us what are the gaps. I'm pleased that AMH is here in the audience too, and I'm hoping that we have an opportunity to ask them a few questions about what are some of the steps they're doing in their department with regard to these bills. So I don't want to say too much right now because I really want to leave time for the people who are going through this firsthand, and in that regard, I am really honored to have the involvement of my colleague, Representative Frederick.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm State Representative Lou Frederick, District 43, that's North and Northeast Portland. This is not an academic exercise for me. This is a very personal one. And it comes because, quite frankly, my wife has been struggling with mental health issues for quite some time. And that means the rest of us have been struggling with mental health issues. I didn't bring it down here, but at some point you should stop by my office and you'll see one of her paintings on the wall. She's an excellent painter, and that's a plug for anybody who'd like to buy any of her paintings. You can't buy this one, however, because it describes something that started taking place in about 1993. She calls it Voices. It is a painting that shows at least eight of her different personalities. At one point, it was unclear who I was coming home to each day, or who I would meet each hour, because she was in such trauma and psychosis. We hospitalized her every 3 to 6 months, starting in about 1992, and that went through to, well, she has been hospitalized now for about a year and a half, 2 years, and so I'm feeling pretty good about that. But the struggle is that when she was hospitalized, it was unclear a lot of things. One was that I couldn't tell you what medication she was taking. So when the emergency room people were asking me that, I couldn't tell them that because I didn't have the information about what medication she was taking. And she was in no case in the emergency room to tell them, really. When she was discharged, if she had broken her leg or had some other surgery, they would have told me how to take care of her. When she left the hospital, I didn't know. I had no clue. And they would just say, I hope she's going to do well. They would tell her she had been struggling with a number of things by that time, and that could be 2 or 3 days or a couple of times, a couple of weeks after she had just gone into the hospital. So we have a number of issues that I'm trying to work with this, is to try to find some way to provide resources for family members and others to help in discharge. It's also a way, and I think this is an important factor that's much larger than this particular situation, it's a way of acknowledging that we have folks in our communities and in our families who are dealing with mental health issues constantly. And breaking through that stigma is a very important factor. And I would encourage you to talk with the folks from NAMI at some point to find out how they're dealing with that, because they're doing a very good job, in my view, statewide, to try to really approach these issues. But we need to find some way to help those families, help those friends, help the community actually do well with people who have been in hospitalization centers of one form or another, so that they are given information as they're discharged. That's my reason for
being involved in this. It's as I said, it's personal, but I think it's also universal for us. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Penn?
Mr. Chair?
Yes. I'll have a camera.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing these to us. I guess more in the way of comment than question. It's sad that it's taken so many years to have these. You know, we go back into the 80s and stuff didn't get resolved. We supposedly had mental health parity. This stuff didn't get solved. And we can go through quite a litany of steps. We had advocates with NAMI and all kinds of different groups. And I'm shaking my head too, wondering, well, will this do it? And I'm hoping it does, because obviously the need is gigantic. And I can remember back in the 80s, people getting discharged from hospitals with absolutely no planning. Well, what was going to happen? I mean, you didn't have to be a genius to foresee the future. And people had no idea where to turn or how to get help. And that's continued all these years. And
thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Kenemer, the first time that I sat on the dais, I think it was actually in this room, for the Human Services Committee back in 2000, it would have been 2010, because I'd just been appointed, the first thing that came up was a concern about the protocol regarding emergency rooms. And we struggled with the fact that I had just had to deal with bringing my wife into an emergency room and finding out that because she was in the emergency room, they didn't feed anybody in the emergency room because they never expected you to stay. Well, she had been sitting in the emergency room for 16 hours. And so we started to change some of those things piece by piece. This is a big step, and I think it will have a much larger impact than we've had in a while, and I'm looking forward. I hope we were able to get this through. Thank you.
Senator Buehler.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. Thanks for bringing this important issue to our attention. I personally had a similar experience this summer, and it's a big impediment to getting care of those that you love. And so this is really urgently needed, and I totally support your efforts.
Thank you.
I just want to thank you both for your comments, and you are going to hear some stories about how, unfortunately, since the 80s, these challenges are still happening, and I am really committed to working with all of you to fine-tune the details and figure out who should be doing what, but I would hate to see another session go by where we don't tackle this head-on, so I really appreciate your commitment.
Representative, will you come up and help us call the panels?
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Representative Wagner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it actually is for Representative Frederick.
Great.
Because this is a tough issue, and I've spent time with NAMI in different places. My question, one of the things that I've noticed, and it seems like it's a problem, is just not so even with the patient, but it's involving the family or letting them know what's going on. So, I mean, did you have any outreach to you at all? Because that's the thing I've noticed. It's there's nothing, no outreach to the family to help them on how to deal with the loved one who's struggling with this.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee, Representative Widener. You're absolutely correct. Melody has managed to go to, I think, every mental health facility and hospital facility in the metro area at least once over the last 20-plus years. And the inconsistency is pretty clear. It really depends on where we are and who is talking with us and how long she's been there. So this is an attempt to try to at least give some consistency to how we deal with discharge issues. That's exactly the point. Thank you.
If I may follow up?
Yep. We got a bunch of witnesses.
Oh, okay. I mean, that was the big thing I noticed is involving the family members is one of the big problems I see in our mental health issues as well. And that's why, I mean, with your personal and being involved with this long is why I appreciate you being here. So anything you can give us on that, I would greatly appreciate. So because of your involvement.
We certainly appreciate you sharing your story.
Sure.
Thank you. Would you call the next panel, please?
Jerry Gabay, Julie
Majors.
Majors, and Riley. Is it Riley Majors?
Yes. Did she want to testify?
Yeah, we were actually going to have Riley come up with Pasco and Diane.
Okay. Sure.
So, okay. I don't know who.
Yes, ma'am.
We're going to have Riley and somebody else?
Is that after.
Yeah, and two other.
After them.
Okay. Go for it.
Did you want Riley and the others up there with you, or do you want to go, they'll go after you?
They'll go in a panel. Okay. Alone. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairperson Greenlick, Vice Chairs Hayden and Noss, and esteemed members of the committee. My name is Jerry Gabay. I'm a member of the NAMI Oregon State Board of Directors, co-chair of Providence Health System's Partnership Council for Behavioral Health, a member of the new Oregon State Young Adult Suicide Prevention Steering Committee, and co-author of the Oregon Psychiatric Physicians Association Suicide Prevention Checklist, which you have previously been provided by committee staff. But I'd like to make clear that today I am not testifying as a representative of any group, but as a grieving parent. Please let me take a moment to tell you about my daughter. Susanna was delightful from the moment of her birth, pretty, cheerful, with a smile that was truly infectious. She loved to travel and was fluent in Spanish. She was a semifinalist at the 2006 Oregon State Speech and Debate Tourney, a pole vaulter and sprinter on the track team, and valedictorian of Hodura Valley High School in 2007. Yet she was also afflicted with mental illness. Between her junior year of high school and her junior year of college, she saw a variety of providers in Hood River, Portland, and Eugene. She was very proud of being accepted into the Honors College at the U of O with a presidential scholarship, but there she seemed to retreat more and more into herself. In the spring of 2010, just after her 21st birthday, she suffered a psychotic episode which resulted in her being placed in the secure psychiatric unit at Sacred Heart Hospital in Eugene. Her discharge plan was minimal. The only follow-up appointment the hospital made for her was with a psychiatrist 30 days after she left the hospital. 1 month after her discharge, 1 day after missing that appointment, she took her life. I'm here today because I am hoping to spare others the pain I live with daily in my life. I want to make you aware of three things which might have saved my daughter, which might save others in the future, and which are encapsulated in House Bills 2948, 2022, and 2023. The first item would be much greater communication between providers and the caregivers, by blood or affinity, of their patients. Even where the patient has signed a release, many providers are just not accustomed to communicating with families. At a minimum, providers must be encouraged to seek authorizations to communicate with appropriate supporters of the patient and then actually communicate. HB 2948 attempts to do this. There is ample literature indicating that extensive communication is a best practice for therapy and suicide prevention, but ample communication is not standard procedure. Why? I believe that it is because many, perhaps most, practitioners have a misunderstanding of HIPAA, which has both blinded them to the need to communicate, as well as to the legal and ethical strictures that encourage communication. I'd like to take a few moments to outline what House Bill 2948 does, and as importantly, what it does not do, as some persons may be misinterpreting that bill. HB 2948 does not modify HIPAA in any way. The exceptions to confidentiality contained in Section 2 sub B are already in HIPAA and were emphasized in both the letter of Federal Health and Human Services Secretary Leon Rodriguez in 2013 and in the Office of Civil Rights Guidance on HIPAA of February 2014, both of which have been provided to the committee. The bill does not require anything, but like HIPAA, it permits providers to breach confidentiality where the exceptions apply in the interest of preserving the life and health of the patient. It does neither require nor even suggest that communication must be made to a patient's family or other blood relation. Disclosures may be made to, I quote, a family member, other relative, a close personal friend, or other person identified by the individual. If one or more of these persons are part of the problem, then of course it would be inappropriate to communicate with them. This bill encourages providers to seek early on to learn from the patient whom they trust and who would be likely to support them. The types of communication mentioned in Section 3 of the bill are cited as best practices by a variety of national organizations and are encouraged by the National Strategy on Suicide Prevention adopted by SAMHSA 2 years ago. Virtually every major national professional association has an exception for communicating with family under certain circumstances. Harm to self is always one of those circumstances. The immunity from civil suit in state courts contained in Section 3, Sub 2 would encourage greater communication, analogous to that currently in ORS 109.680, but in no way mandates anything. And of course, it does not and could not purport to grant immunity in federal courts. The second issue.
Are you going to be wrapping up soon?
Pretty soon.
We have about 20 witnesses and we have about 40 minutes.
2 minutes, I'll bet.
Thank you.
The second issue that might have saved Susanna's life concerns discharges and is the purview of 2023 and the proposed amendments to it drafted by legislative counsel. Discharges from hospital care must be much better coordinated with the resources in the community and with whatever support system the patient has. And I'll give you one quick example of this problem. Susanna was at Sacred Heart Hospital for over a week, the week of Easter 2010. Her mother and I spent the whole week down there every day. We asked staff when she'd be discharged and told her we wanted to be part of that conference and the planning for it, and Susanna had signed a release. So HIPAA didn't even come into it. Susanna had signed a release. We were told that they did not know when she would be discharged. And we said, well, we will visit with her on Easter Sunday and then go back up to the area in which we lived up in Northern Oregon in order to resume our jobs. The very next morning, Monday morning at 10 o'clock, her mother got a call from the hospital saying Susanna had been discharged. They discharged her without ensuring that she had an informed and present support system to help her transition and keep her alive. The point is, communication must be robust rather than ignored, and the patient's support system engaged in the discharge process. HB 2023 is a giant step in that direction. The last item of the three is coordination of care or case management. A report from the Suicide Prevention Resource Center in 2011 stated that as many as 70% of suicide attempters of all ages will never make it to their first outpatient appointment. It continued on to say, scheduling the first outpatient appointment within 48 to 72 hours of discharge and making reminder phone calls are among the successful strategies identified. When Susanna left the hospital, there was no one to coordinate her care, so she didn't drop through the cracks. Her mom and I might have, had they informed us of more fully of her diagnosis, of the warning signs of suicide, the risk factors, and actions we could take. We were the only ones with the time or level of concern in order to do this, as are so many other parents. But we weren't informed, so we left it up to the professionals, and frankly, they failed. There could be a solution for this by requiring coordination of care and payment for that coordination, which is the bill 2022. Sadly, my story is not unique. I speak with numerous parents across the state, and this melancholic situation is more common than not. We can work together to improve the situation, to save the lives of those we love. I, for one, am devoting the rest of my life to make that come true. Please join me. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Hello, Chairperson Greenlick, Vice Chairs Hayden and Nose, and esteemed members of the committee. My name is Julie Majors. I work as a family advocate and educator at NAMI Multnomah. I serve on several children's mental health advisory councils and the New Oregon Young Adult Suicide Prevention Steering Committee. I'm most importantly a mother with two kids ages 20 and 24 who are entering their young adulthoods as contributing and productive members of our community. I urge you to move toward passing House Bills 2948, 2022, and 2023. My personal experiences advocating for my daughter will describe to you why they are critically important to saving lives. In a report titled Continuity of Care for Suicide Prevention and Research, it is stated, for patients at risk of suicide, discharge from an emergency room or psychiatric inpatient facility is all too often the beginning of a difficult journey across the landscape of a disarrayed mental health care system. Once patients are discharged, the complexity of coordinating and continuing mental health care is confounded by existing fragmentations and gaps in services among service providers. Please let me describe to you how my experiences reflected this grim assessment. In 2011, my daughter was 16 years old, and in desperate moments of her darkest days, she attempted suicide two times in less than 30 days. At the first ED visit, after swallowing three bills of over-the-counter medication, workers performed what the attending doctor told me was their protocol in such situations: tend to the medical crisis, medically clear her, ask her if she actively wanted to hurt herself, and then send her back home just 12 hours later. I was certain this wasn't enough to address the conditions that brought us there that night, and I pushed back strongly enough that they admitted her to the next available bed in an adolescent psychiatric unit. I thought naively that there she would be fully evaluated and we would be given long overdue answers and medical recommendations for how to address her unmanageable challenges. What we actually experienced upon discharge was the following: an assessment that fell short of revealing what we were really dealing with by way of a diagnosis and was based on a physician having read her file and visiting with her for two 10-minute sessions. A treatment plan that fell dramatically short of addressing her illness. The plan entailed following up with her outpatient therapists, appointments they did help us set up, and to be placed on a waiting list for a treatment program that she may or may not get access into. And perhaps most importantly, a failure to inform me of the severity of her condition from a clinical perspective, her increased risk of suicide, and the critical importance of getting a qualified team of practitioners to do a more thorough evaluation and create a treatment plan to meet her needs. In other words, educating me and her on her conditions and what we needed to do to tend to them. All of this led to a second suicide attempt less than 2 weeks after her discharge and a costly rehospitalization, although luckily not a completed suicide. That second hospitalization was so predictable that the attending psychiatrist told me that mine was the kind of kid who would likely experience recurring hospitalizations before he would be able to diagnose her, and then went on to predict a diagnosis at age 18 that he couldn't make given her age at the time. Not once did he suggest that with intensive and consistent care, then and over the course of the following 2 years, that we might intercept such a diagnosis. What I learned as a parent in that indescribably traumatic month was that I would have to fight hard in a system that seemed to have practices designed to move patients out of its facilities, but isn't designed well to help them with a plan to address their needs in the community. At the time of my daughter's second discharge, armed with a skilled advocate by my side, we insisted on a plan that would better place us on a path of effective treatment and recovery. This included a clinically appropriate step down in care, a thorough evaluation that revealed what treatment plan should look like for her, transition to a residential placement back to home that put in place a longer-term plan to meet her clinical, educational, and social needs, and a better informed parent with the supports I needed to help her follow her treatment plans over the long haul. These all led us through the hardest parts of her recovery and a smooth transition into adulthood, where she continues to be supported in ways that help her to incrementally take on more responsibilities in her life. In fact, she is here today to bravely share with you her own perspectives of these experiences. What we present is a success story of what is possible when we as a community get it right, and I'm so very grateful for this. It is heartbreaking that too many other families have not been so fortunate, and I wish that we would all find this to be unacceptable. I firmly believe that the content of these three bills will save lives. What they describe are the many evidence-based and best practices that saved my daughter's life.
Oregon has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation. These are preventable losses. Riley and I are here today revealing what is possible so that you may help the other many families who are desperately seeking care and support for their children. And I thank you very much for your time and attention on these bills.
Thank you. You call the next panel, please.
Thank you.
We have a dilemma, and that's we have another 12 people to testify. We have another bill to hear, and we've been told we have to be out exactly at 1:45. So I'm going to ask the future witnesses if you could hold your testimony to 2 minutes, and we're going to put a timer on you because that's the only way we're going to hear from all of you, and many of you have come a long way to testify. So please call the next panel.
Riley Majors, and I'm sorry, who? Thank you. Because no. Kesko. And you. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's why.
Okay. Hello. My name is Kazuko Arai Gardner. I'm here today to speak with you about my experiences related to House Bill 2948. On February 24, 2014, I lost my daughter, Jackie, to suicide. A suicide that could have been prevented had her healthcare providers shared with us the knowledge that she had bought a handgun 2 weeks prior. And was planning to kill herself. Excuse me. Knowledge that both her therapist and her psychiatrist had, but did not share. We assume due to a fear of violating HIPAA. That fear was apparently so strong that they ignored the release of information forms that Jackie had signed and was on file. It was only by accident that we learned Jackie's therapist and her psychiatrist had known Jackie had purchased a gun and had even discussed it among themselves. If not for a slip-up by her therapist, it would have never come to light. Had it been shared with us in a timely fashion, it is very likely that Jackie would still be with us today. Jackie had bipolar disorder and had previously attempted suicide and as such was at high risk of attempting it again. Yet none of her healthcare providers cared enough to reach out to the very people who could have made a difference. They will claim that privacy protections provided by HIPAA prevented them from disclosing anything to us. I would like to tell you a bit about the incredible daughter I lost. Jackie was an artist, an actor, a model, a singer, a writer, a comedian, a dancer, a choreographer. She had many friends. Jackie always prepared breakfast in bed for me on Mother's Day with a flower in a vase. She spent a year in Sendai, Japan as an exchange student. And in 2008, Jackie graduated from the Arts and Communication Magnet Academy in Beaverton as a valedictorian. She earned a scholarship to Northwestern University in Chicago, where she studied communications. She has such a bright future. She was only 23. Bipolar disorder is a brain illness that can impair an individual's ability to fully understand and comprehend the implications of their behavior and actions. The illness makes the sufferer very impulsive, and they often live in the moment with little or no concern to the future. Resulting poor decisions often have dire consequences, such as the loss of friends and other relationships. Sometimes the immediate family members are the only ones left that care enough to support them through their illness. When healthcare providers do not communicate with the family members, they lose their critical support. Sometimes family members are their last lifeline to help them navigate through our fragmented, dysfunctional mental health care system. As our experiences show, healthcare providers often do not have the same level of care and concern as the family members.
I need to ask you to...
Excuse me.
Put your testimony, please.
Excuse me,
how do you? I need to ask you that.
Okay, one more paragraph. We need to provide clear and concise directions to the healthcare community that motivates them to familiarize themselves with the existing provisions within HIPAA that both allow and encourage them to communicate with families and loved ones when it was warranted. Therefore, I urge you to pass HB 2948 and let families and loved ones be part of the team caring for people living with mental illness. What we are going through could have been prevented. There may be many other unknown cases like ours because of HIPAA, and we may just be the tip of the iceberg. Please take a stand and don't let this happen to another loving, supportive Oregon family. Jackie's middle name is Sakura, which means cherry blossoms. When you step outside today and see the cherry blossoms in bloom, please remember what happened to my daughter, Jackie Sakura. Thank you.
And that testimony was 6 minutes, which means if we continue at that pace, we'll have room for about four more of the 12 people left. And so we need to go one way or another. We either need to ask you to speed it up, or we're just going to have to cut it off and let other people not have a chance to testify.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, my name is Riley Majors. I'm 20 years old. I live in Portland. I'm here today to talk about my experiences as a teenager struggling through the mental health care system. You've already heard from my mother, Julie, and what it was like for her to navigate my care. I thought it was equally important to share with you my experience as the patient. I displayed a lot of signs from small child of emotional dysregulation that earned me the title of being a difficult child. It wasn't until I was 12 years old that those signs started to look like a much more serious problem. My parents had discovered that I was self-mutilating after a regular checkup exam with my pediatrician, at which point they did the only thing that they knew how to do, which was to find me the first counselor available. However, I was too determined to keep my secrets and my suffering to myself that I proved again to be too difficult for this particular person. As a freshman in high school, when I found a therapist whose determination was just as strong as mine, and while she was a key part in my ultimate recovery, at the time, one therapist was not enough to stop my declining stability. In January of my junior year, I made my first suicide attempt. My hospital stay was short and easy to manipulate. The only requirements to qualify me for discharge were to fill out a single double-spaced page of questions regarding how I was feeling nearing my discharge and to appear stable enough to go home, the latter of which being very flexible. I was sent home with two medications, both of which I had very little information on, and I had not been equipped with the skills to be able to ask what exactly they were and what exactly they were treating. And then 3 weeks later, I made my second attempt. It was during the second hospitalization, as my mother briefly spoke about, I was unofficially diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, a disorder that I do not carry today. And she was told that I was going to be repeatedly hospitalized until I was 18 and could be officially diagnosed. I could detail the rest of my story with faults in my treatment plans and how the system has failed me, but I do not want to leave you with fault. I want to leave you with ambition to do more. I was not special. I was no different than anyone else I was hospitalized with, but my carefully chosen outpatient care team was. And the care that they provided me was, and the coordination was very different. I knew about HIPAA and the release of information, and it was signing those releases and the active participation of my therapists and family members that allowed the seamless coordination of care on the path to recovery for me. Unfortunately, two girls that I was in treatment with and had befriended at 16 within a year of discharge both died. I believe that if these bills were set in place, if these kids had the same safety precautions that I had, there is a chance that they may still be alive today. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for your story. Yes.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Diane Mayer. As a mother of a teenage daughter with mental illness, I'm here to tell you why I believe that House Bill 2023 is important. My daughter, Madeline, attempted suicide when she was in seventh grade. It was a life-changing experience for our family. Maddie came to me in the middle of the night to tell me that she had just swallowed 40 prescription pills. It came out of nowhere, and I was not prepared for what was ahead. I drove her to the emergency room at Providence in Portland. She was then taken by ambulance to the pediatric intensive care unit at Emmanuel, where she spent the next 2 days. When Maddie's heart rate was finally stabilized, she was admitted to the psychiatric ward at Emmanuel, where she spent the following 2 weeks. My husband and I are both educated professionals, but neither of us had any experience with the mental health system. We believed that the hospital and psychiatric ward staff were the experts. We didn't know how critical it was for us to be her advocate. When they told us that it was time for Maddie to be discharged, we drove to the hospital and picked her up. The only follow-up the hospital recommended was for her to be enrolled in dialectical behavioral therapy. We called Portland DBT and were told that there was a 4-month waiting list. Maddie was discharged from the hospital during the first week of June, 1 week before school let out for summer. That summer, Maddie spent all of her time in her bedroom, mostly in bed sleeping. She did not interact with anyone socially, did not shower, brush her teeth, wash her hair, or get dressed. It was depressing. I felt paralyzed with fear and my inability to help her. I tried to make sure that she was in a safe environment each day when I left for work. We locked up all medications and anything sharp so she couldn't hurt herself. That summer was the darkest period in my life. I was tormented with guilt about not being at home with her, yet I felt powerless to help her when I was at home. I was terrified that when I got home from work and opened her bedroom door, I would find her hanging from a bedpost. I knew that if she wanted to harm herself or kill herself, she could find a way to do it. We endured the nightmare for 3 months. I would not wish that summer on my worst enemy. It was pure torture for our entire family. Eventually, we found a residential facility and had her admitted. Most parents do not expect their children to experience mental health crises, and when it happens, they believe the mental health system is there to help them navigate their way through it. We did not know where to turn for help. In fact, we didn't even know what help we needed. Some of the things I learned were that we needed to ask for a mental health evaluation. We needed to ask questions about the medications that were being prescribed, and we needed to educate ourselves about her condition so that we would know what to watch for. Having a team of mental health care providers to support and guide us would have been so helpful. We were so inexperienced, we muddled our way through the summer and ended up admitting her to residential for 3 months, and it was $900 a day. I truly believe that if House Bill 2023 had been in place, residential care and the high cost of it could have been avoided. We understand that there are many things that cannot be changed. Maddie will always struggle with mental illness, but we should change the things we can. Thank you for listening to my story, although it's a story I wish I didn't have to tell.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Was it 2 minutes?
No, close enough. We're just not going to have time for all the witnesses, so we'll call them in order and see how far we get.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This is, I know, very difficult for you, and I can tell you for my colleagues, it's very difficult for us as well. We're sharing your suffering in a way that's very important.
Katie King, Doug Riggs, and Chris Bonoff.
You guys can be fast.
Yes.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Katie King, and I'm here today representing OSEP, the Oregon chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. My testimony has been submitted for the record, but I do want to say that OSEP supports this bill. Thank you.
That's a perfect testimony. Thank you very much. Mr. Riggs.
Members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, Doug Riggs, on behalf of the Oregon Alliance for Children's Programs, these are very good bills. They should pass. You have our written testimony. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Now we're getting somewhere.
Chair Greenlick,
you've members. Never been that fast.
I probably won't be this time. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'm Chris Bonneff. I'm here representing the Oregon State Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. I want to thank Representative Kenny Geyer for bringing forward these issues. To Representative Kenemer's point, there is a reason why these haven't been addressed. We've only had parity in this state for 10 years, and it took 10 years to get there. This is the embodiment of these bills, and I think to Representative Kenny Geyer's point, and I think my colleague from the hospitals will say that there's conversation that needs to take place to get the language in such that we get to the place where we want to be, which is the bill's intent. But this is a natural evolution to begin working on some of these issues in the type of healthcare environments we're talking about, because we've never had those conversations before, because we just swept these issues under the rug. I do think that again, the bills, NAMI's position is the intent of the bills, we favor them. We think there's some mechanics that need to be worked out in the language to get us to a product that is beneficial and that also recognizes those circumstances when communication is inappropriate, so that we safeguard those individuals where that family relationship may be destructive. But we do have commitment from the hospitals and others to work together, which is very encouraging. So I hope to be able to come back at some point before the same committee and say, we got it and we're ready to go. Thank you.
Let's do it fast, because we have it. By April 10th, we have to post all our work sessions. So.
For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I represent the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. Mr. Bonneff mentioned that we're all working together. We are. We're working with NAMI and with Representative Kenny Geyer's office to find some language that makes sense and try to put them all in one bill. And as for the bill for HIPAA, we're pretty neutral on that bill because federal HIPAA guidelines and regulations govern what we do. If this is an explanation of those, then that just helps us. But on the other two bills, at this point, we're opposed as written, but we are working with everybody to try to get to yes on those, and I think we're doing a pretty good job. One quick thing. You know, hospitals have been in everybody's testimony what happened with their personal thing. I think our folks in our acute care units have very, very difficult jobs. Our nurse practitioners, nurses, and mental health folks, very difficult jobs. I think they do up to this point the best they can, but I do know through listening to all the testimony and meeting with everybody that we can do a better job. But we also need the other side, the community, to meet us at the door and follow through with the outpatient planning.
Absolutely true.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, guys. Come to the panel.
Jessica Adamson, Elizabeth Remley, and then we have three more after that.
Oh, okay. If you guys are that fast, then
yes,
we can get to the last three. That would be great, because we have another bill I want to hear.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Providence Health and Services. We just want to start by saying thank you to the committee for hearing these bills and to the advocates for their courage in coming forward and sharing their stories. We provide a lot of inpatient mental health care. We absolutely support the goals in this bill and look forward to working with NAMI and the advocates to get to a place where the language works, but absolutely support the intent of what these bills are trying to do to improve mental health care in Oregon.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, Elizabeth Remley here today on behalf of Cambia, Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield. I want to echo Jessica's support for these bills. We do support the intent of the bills, and we're grateful that these bills are here and that you're hearing them. And we commend the advocates for what they're doing on these bills. We pay for a lot of these services, and we want to continue to pay for these services. We want to work with the advocates and with everyone else to figure out exactly how to write the language to make sure that we can do that in a way that is still cost-efficient and efficient for the providers. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, and the last three, Clay Peterson, Drake Eubank, and Becky Child.
Let me see that bill, the next one. Go for it.
All right. Hello, Chairman Greedlick and the rest of the committee. I'm Clay Peterson. I am currently Associate Director at ROC, the Recovery Outreach Community Center here in Salem. And we share, I guess, a lot of the concerns that Nami just mentioned. I'm going to keep this as short as possible, but
please.
What we are really worried about is just, I know that a lot of the peers were a peer service. Yeah, we provide peer support and give a location for people with mental health and addiction issues to come to in order to share stories, share life experiences, and work through that. And part of the problem that we have is just that a lot of people, when we brought this bill up with them, are very, very scared of it. A lot of people have stories and families that do have backgrounds that where this is not something that is seen as helpful or comforting to them, and it's something that really is more terrifying. And I know, when you're dealing with communities that are suffering from PTSD, trauma, anxiety, depression, and a wide variety of mental health issues, this is something that can be really common, is that you don't have that support network, and that's the support network we're trying to build at ROC and that other peer support places are trying to build. And I think that it's scary to have a bill where you have a doctor who just met someone deciding what information should be given out. And obviously there's a million stories of really supportive families like we heard today where maybe that would have beneficial consequences, but there are also ones where you're basically throwing people back into a toxic relationship of codependency, and you're throwing people you're giving people information when they're in an abusive relationship. You're giving people information that they don't want to have given out, and as written, the bill is letting you do that just because someone is in a state that the medical professional sees as I read it, even manic, or just kind of, they don't even have to be necessarily incapacitated. So I think that it's something that we need to be really careful of, because there are people out there who don't want that information out there and need to be protected. And so instead of reading what I wrote, that was my short version.
Thank you. And yep. I think we are worrying about that. I expect that's going to be an important part. You're absolutely right.
And I really appreciate that. It sounds like that is the language that you guys are trying to fix. I guess the only thing I would add as just one last thing is that, I know that advanced directives are something that they have brought up in the past as something that has not worked great. I think that, if we're really talking about moving a default rule and deciding whether you're going to give out information by default or not give out information by default, I have a lot more faith that a family unit that has a lot of people who are really supportive and really willing to help, that they are going to be able to navigate that system to create an advanced directive that will work for them a lot better than someone who is in a more toxic relationship and doesn't know that that's coming up. And if they have to affirmatively go and write down people they don't want this information to get to, it's not going to happen, just with the population, with the resources that takes, and with the support they have. It's not something that a lot of people are going to be able to do.
Thank you very much.
My name is Drake Eubank. I'm from the Eugene Springfield area. I am a in-home care worker currently, a PCA for the mental health program. I bill the state directly. The clients, the people that are actually the clients themselves, are my employers. I'm paid by voucher. I highly recommend this because it allows me regular contact in the community with my the person that I help, and I can usually gauge on a day-to-day basis how that person is doing, a lot better than having a clinician sitting in an office or somebody sitting in an emergency room. So I would just like to throw that in there, is that people are looking for ways to connect up the community. The model that you have for personal support workers, in-home care workers, is excellent right now. And they're starting. I was on the bargaining unit in 2013 and negotiated the current contract, and it's really a very good and very economical step. There's no administrative cost. Mental health costs you 50% of every dollar you spend goes to administration. PCA program, it's like 5%. So anyway, I just want to throw that out there. I have worked as a qualified mental health associate and worked for Linton County as a QMHA. I also would like to say, in the interest of time, that I never go out without SPF 15 on a sunny day.
You're at the age where it may make a little less difference.
I mean, you can't be so sure.
Can't be sure. Thank you for the support of that bill, too.
The one thing that I did want to say, I do have a story to tell. It's was about somebody that I did work with, and this is a, these are the unintended consequences. He was fairly eloquent in addressing. But I worked for a long time with a woman who was severely abused as a child and molested by her father for a long number of years. And her mother was in the home and knew about it the whole time. I'm quite surprised at this point that she was alive when I met her. Sometimes even surprised that she could speak English well, because of the amount of trauma that she managed to go through. They estimate that probably between 60 and 80% of the people in the public mental health system that have what used to be before DSM-5 Access 1 diagnoses have experienced some form of trauma or abuse. And that's really important to notice when you're trying to create privacy for a person or choice. And I wholly support the idea of advanced directives and an active participation rather than making a law giving that authority to anybody that wants to use it, essentially. Because in the past, that hasn't really worked out very well, as far as I can tell. This person eventually had a daughter. She didn't do very well, and even though she loved her daughter very much, she lost that daughter. And when the system was consulted, the professionals involved, guess who they gave the daughter to? The mother. So, and this is the kind of situation that you end up with, where the contacts that you end up having are going to be something that people can tell you they don't want, or maybe can't tell you they don't want, but are going to have unintended consequences that are far worse than not having a parent know. So,
thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlake. My name is Becky Child. I am an adjunct professor at Portland State. I'm also somebody who's been hospitalized 23 times for psychiatric purposes, and I have been doing mental health advocacy for 15 years, in primarily the adult system, but also with some children and families. I have some recommendations to suggest. I oppose these bills. I appreciate the intent, but I do oppose them because I think they're way too broad. Has any of you looked recently at what a release of information form actually looks like?
Could I suggest, we are running out of time and I'm going to close
okay.
the
All right.
Could you submit the suggestions to the committee in writing, please?
I would be happy to. But the idea of the, what most forms look like right now is a blank check. And if I asked you to write me a blank check right now, I don't think anybody would write me a blank check. There's a, if you ask somebody, what would you want me to tell your mom and dad if they were called because they were worried about you? That's a different question that has a different answer than just signing a blank form that says you can contact and talk to my family. Asking people what they want to have shared is more helpful in the long run. I also am a member of the Oregon State Hospital Advisory Board, which I'm not testifying on behalf of, but one of the things that I've been working with is the with the director of social work at the state hospital, and we have created a form that the hospital will use in transferring patients into the community. And there's no reason why that cannot be a statewide form, rather than having all the different CCOs and their forms, that we have some uniformity in terms of information.
I need to close the hearing.
All right. Thank you.
Please send
okay.
your comments in writing. I very much appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2022, 2023, 2948, and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2933. We have, as usual, circumstances. I think we have four people who are in opposition to this bill. I'd like to call them as the first panel, but why don't you tell us what this bill is?
House Bill 2933 authorizes the Oregon Medical Board to impose civil penalties on persons not licensed by the board. This declares an emergency and is effective on passage. Christian Wolf, Eric Dover, and I apologize, it's John, and I can't read the last name. Carpenter?
Is that all the opposed?
Yeah. The other guy was on the mental health list. He
okay.
signed up on
give you a lot more time.
You have, as you can see, probably 3 minutes.
H.
That's good. I won't need much time. My name is Eric Dover. I'm a physician and a former victim of abuse by the Oregon Medical Board. Dear representatives, HB 2933 seems extremely vague and lacking in text. I've been unable to find a full version of this bill, if there even is one. As a result, I have some questions regarding HR 2933, and I don't expect any answers at this time. First of all, I'd like to know who's responsible for this bill. Secondly, I'd like to know, was the Oregon Medical Board involved in its inception, used for consultation, or both? I'd like to know what the reason is for the sudden proposal of this bill. Has there been a problem with individuals practicing medicine without a license? If so, how significant of a problem is it? Who can this bill target? Does the Oregon Medical Board receive the money generated by these fines? If not, who does? And in closing, I'd just like to say it's interesting that the House Bill 2933, a revenue-generating bill, is being introduced at the same time the Oregon Medical Board is vying to become autonomous from the legislative budget process. Can anyone else see the conflict of interest associated with this? The same conflict already exists regarding fines levied against physicians and other health care providers by the Oregon Medical Board. We have a state board that is not just dependent on licensing fees to supposedly survive, but also fines. Here's a scenario. The Oregon Medical Board needs some funds, so they go out and find an individual or an entity. Not a problem for them, because they already have had a lot of practice with this with physicians. The Oregon Medical Board is given immunity for any mistakes, poor performance, or even malicious behavior directed towards physicians and other health care providers. Therefore, they can fine with impunity. They never have to worry about oversight. They're never held to a standard anywhere near what physicians are held to. Thank you for your time.
I can answer a couple of those questions. And the bill is only a paragraph long. I'm probably responsible for the bill, and the board is cool to the bill rather than happy about it. And I'm cool about their intention of becoming a semi-independent. So I hope that answers some of your questions. This is not a conspiracy laid on you by the board. It's me trying to get them to take responsibility for medical practice by people who are not medical practitioners, who are not licensed practitioners, and they've been very slow to want to do that. So,
who would that be?
The medical board.
No, the people that you're concerned about.
Well, that's a whole long story of days, but it's not you, I assure you. Who's next?
I can go next.
Go for it.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, thank you so very much for having us here today. I really appreciate the process that we go through here. This is clear.
Your name, please.
I'm so sorry. My name is Christian Wolf. I'm a licensed psychologist associate here in Oregon and have been licensed for about 12 years. About 15 years, and have been an Oregon Board of Psychologists examiner's watchdog for nearly as long. I have had plenty of experience of getting to glimpse at the quasi-judicial processes that are a part of administrative law, and have great concerns with this. Licensees are very easily abused, and I would like to, and I have the same concerns for the Oregon Medical Board. And I really think that the judicial processes, when there's been someone who's been accused of something, and they go through an administrative law process, needs to be investigated. This is a very, very dark corner of judicial processes that are, quasi-judicial and bear little resemblance to what we actually have in place in our country through our judicial branch. One of the things with this that I'm concerned about is that beyond the OMB being able to take licensees into their own tribunals, is that this expands the extent to which a nearly private body now is able to grab hold of anyone who they is on their bad side for any reason, and to be able to drag them into an administrative law process and charge them up to $10,000 $20,000, for which they will likely spend $20,000 trying to not have to pay that $10,000 and then end up having to pay all of that. We already have a judicial process. And if the Oregon Medical Board finds fault from their own, on their own or from a complaint generated from any citizen, a civil or a criminal charge can be issued in such a way that it is handled through ordinary judicial means. I'm concerned about some of the people that may be targeted here are among the different people that can be on OMB's bad side to their disliking is alternative health care providers. And now that they have their own independent purse strings, or it can be expected that this will pass, it's gone to the Senate floor now, this is a great time for them to go on a roundup.
I wouldn't necessarily assume it's going to pass.
I like. Thank you. Today happens to be my birthday, my 55th birthday. I'm being kind of cheerful now, but I'm now get to be a mean old man, and that's my birthday present to hear you say that. And I'll wind up for today, and thank you very much for having this hearing, and I'll pass it on to Dr. Gamby.
Thank you. My name's John Gamby. Just a little aside that I picked up from listening to testimony in the last hour or so. I think if a bill like 2933 passes, we'll see a lot of collateral damage in the mental health field. There's literally volumes of literature suggesting that nutritional intervention in mental health fields can have a significant impact on the outcome. Just a couple quick examples. The herb turmeric works almost as well as most antidepressants in controlling depression. And amino acid therapy in addictive behavior works better than anonymous groups. But I'll get back to my testimony here. I've practiced medicine in Oregon for almost 35 years, and during most of that time I had an adversarial relationship with the medical board. My concerns about HB 2933 have nothing to do with that relationship, but it's given me 35 years of experience in dealing with the methods that the medical board uses. Since the purpose of the Medical Practice Act, if we read it carefully, especially at the beginning, is to protect the citizens of the state, not the doctors. I think it's relevant to the question, just how do civil penalties on unlicensed individuals protect the public? These penalties would protect the doctors by limiting the ability of citizens to do more for themselves. But we don't know what or who the medical board had in mind when, or excuse me, Representative Greenlick had in mind when he created this bill. But we do know the board wants to extend its control, as this bill would do, to everyone in the state that's not licensed by the board. When a product like medical care is available in an effective, safe, reasonable price form, customers, consumers do not seek alternatives. Obviously, many do not see available medical services providing this kind of care. House Bill 2933 suggests that independent efforts to prevent or improve the response to an illness may now be the target for civil penalties. It certainly gives the impression that the monopoly does not like competition. According to the Center for Disease Control and National Poison Control data, there have been no deaths from vitamins, minerals, herbal preparations, multi-level products, or a multitude of over-the-counter preparations that are now available. On the other hand, according to the Journal of the American Medical Association, almost 300,000 people a year die from what they call iatrogenic disease, which is a disease caused by your doctor. And that's the real epidemic. And it's difficult to see what the medical board is doing about this epidemic, or in reality, to see what the medical board is doing in general. Having experienced the trauma and expense of administrative hearings, I would testify it's a form of terrorism. The board is in total control of these hearings, dates, timing, witnesses, the judge, and in the end, if they don't like the decision, they can ignore it. Very few businesses or individuals can survive administrative hearings. Administrative hearings are a great form of intimidation, and HB 2933 exposes most of the citizens of the state to this draconian threat, and I cannot see that in any way protects the citizens. If someone doesn't have a medical license and is harming people, there are many of mechanisms involved for correcting that problem. But paying a civil penalty to the medical board versus going to jail, I don't think there's any question. And Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I guess we have time for one more witness, but as you drive home, think about an unlicensed person taking a scalpel, cutting down a person's back all the way, and then tying laces in their back, having used a scalpel to open up their skin.
Well, Representative Green, I think that person should obviously be in jail.
Well, but there's nothing that puts them in jail now because they're not regulated by the medical board, and there's not a felony or a misdemeanor created by that. It is practice, in my mind, practicing medicine without a license. And those are the targets I'm looking at. People injecting Botox into people's body without physician supervision. There are a variety of things like that that the medical board, when we push on them, says they don't have authority to do that because they regulate licensees and not people who are practicing medicine without a license.
Representative Green,
I can just tell you that's the target of what this bill is.
Well,
that's
I understand, and that's a fine target. I don't think any of us are against protecting the public. But I think that there's some error in this reasoning. Imagine someone is in a courtroom being tried for a crime. They're being tried because we don't know if they did it or not. The jury's convinced that the crime is a heinous crime, so something must be done about it. There's a person in the room who's been accused. We'll assume that this is the person who's done it. Similarly, what we have is a great concern about harm being done to people by people who are not licensed to practice medicine, do not practice it competently, what have you. The public does need to be protected. But this does not, the error in this reasoning is believing that it's the Oregon Medical Board that needs to see to it. Well, and yes, they are comprised mostly of doctors.
I just want the three of you to know, this bill is not a conspiracy by the medical board. It's not something the medical board even likes very much, but we won't have time to hear that today.
One quick comment.
Yep.
I would think that goes along with forms of piercing and tattooing, because it's one of these things that the young folks or maybe older folks are into now. But doesn't the laws for piercing, aren't those individuals licensed by the state?
We are pushing these, trying to get the board that's responsible for that and the medical board to look at what happens in between the two of them.
Okay.
Yeah, there is a board that deals with body art, piercing, and a variety of things, and they're moving out beyond their licensees as well. They had the same problem. Is if their licensees do something wrong, they can sanction them, but if it's a not licensee that does it, they don't have the authority to sanction them. We're trying to fix that.
But a careful reading of the introduction to House ORS 677 has a very broad definition of practicing medicine. Any even suggestion that you're diagnosing or treating a condition constitute the practice of medicine.
That's right. And currently they don't think they have the ability to sanction people who aren't physicians in doing that, and we're trying to move them in that direction to deal with exactly that.
We may have a rare, unlikely alliance with OMB on this one, then.
I am going to close the public hearing.
Thank you very much.
On House
Happy
Bill
birthday.
2933.
Mr. Chair,
can I say that was an excellent bill? I'm glad we brought it forward today.
This bill.
We'll
see.
We'll see.
No, we're not working
just
the bill.
Just a public hearing.
Just humor.
The sunscreen. We adjourn.
We are adjourned.
Prevent cancer. The sunscreen prevents burns. And the more, the higher the SP.
Right. We get it. Right. We get it.
And the more, the higher the SP.